From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Welcome new affiliates to the ever-growing list of the Coast to Coast family. Here they are, KACIAM in the Dalles in Oregon, KXTLAM in Butte, Montana, WSRM-FM in Rome, Georgia, KIMLAM in Gillette, Wyoming, and WWVAAM in Wheeling, West Virginia. Thanks for joining us. You'll like the show. By the way, don't forget Mother's Day Sunday, and we will have, just circle this on your calendar, a live program for you Monday, Memorial Day night. That's May 25th. We'll be here with a live program. As we've been reporting, and now MSNBC is picking up on this huge story, now it's the time for the sun to move into a busier period for sunspots. As a matter of fact, no sunspots yet, but they are getting some coronal mass ejections, a couple areas on the sun starting to erupt. Forecasters expect a relatively mild outbreak so far by historical standards. One major solar storm can cause havoc with satellites and electrical systems like hurricanes. A weak cycle refers to the number of storms, but it only takes one big one to create chaos, according to a scientist at the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration Space Weather Prediction Center. A report by the National Academy of Sciences found that if a storm as severe as one that hit in 1859 occurred right now, it would cause $1 to $2 trillion in damage the first year and would take, and this is the scary part, 4 to 10 years to recover. The 1859 storm shorted out telegraph wires, causing fires in North America and Europe, sent readings of Earth's magnetic field soaring, and produced northern lights so bright that people read newspapers by their light at night. Cyber espionage and attacks from well-funded nations or terror groups are now the biggest threats to the military's computer networks, according to a top U.S. officer. General Kevin Chilton, who heads the U.S. Strategic Command, said he worries that foes will learn to disable or distort battlefield communications. Now, he said even as the Pentagon improves its network defenses against hackers, he needs more people, training, and resources to hone offensive cyber war capacity. At the same time, he says the United States would consider using military force against any enemy who attacks and disrupts the nation's critical networks. At the University of Missouri's Journalism School, where right now almost 100% of the students have Macs, an incoming freshman have just been told this: you will need an iPhone or an iPod Touch as well. Why? Well, according to the associate dean there, Brian Brooks, they can play back lectures in their free time. They say that lectures are the worst possible learning format, but that students will retain a lecture when they hear it the second time, three times as much as the first time. How about that? A top White House aide has resigned for his role in Air Force One's $328,000 photo op flyover above New York City that sparked panic and flashbacks to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Louis Caldera said the controversy had made it impossible for him to effectively lead the White House military office. Moreover, he said, here's his quote, "It has become a distraction to the important work that you are doing as president." He said this in his resignation letter to President Barack Obama. The sight of the huge passenger jet and an F-16 fighter plane flying past the Statue of Liberty in the lower Manhattan financial district sent panic office workers streaming into the streets on April 27. In the St. Louis area, severe thunderstorms in the Midwest have killed 4 people, collapsing a church, knocking out power to thousands. In southern Missouri, 2 people killed near Poplar Bluff when wind knocked a tree onto their car. And a man in his 70s had a heart attack after wind picked him up and threw him into a building. Officials in Kansas say a person died there, too. Residents of Santa Barbara County, California, being warned that they may have to evacuate even more. 30,000 people under a mandatory evacuation already. 75 homes burned. 10% of the fire contained there. Heavy winds. U.S. employers cut 539,000 jobs last month, the fewest since October According to the government data released on Friday that signaled the economy's steep decline, they say, might be easing and gave the stock market another boost today. Our feature story at coasttocoastam.com, the world's first robotic teacher proved a hit with pupils on her first day at a Japanese primary school. One pupil described Seiya as pretty. Another said that she looked a bit scary, but was fun. While another said he couldn't believe he was being taught by a robot. First, she calls the name of each child before asking the pupils to carry out tasks from a textbook for the pilot project at the primary school near Tokyo. Actor Leonard Nimoy admitted to shedding a tear or two while watching the new Star Trek movie. Nimoy played the character Spock in the original Star Trek series, a half-Vulcan, half-human, who usually takes a dispassionate, logical approach to everything. The actor has reprised the role as the older Spock, who talks to his younger self in the new movie. The new Star Trek looks at the origins of the original Starship Enterprise crew and examines how a young Captain Kirk and Spock first struck up their friendship after a rocky start. Director J.J. Abrams, known for his work on television shows such as Lost and Fringe, had said he wanted to make an accessible mainstream movie that stays faithful to the series. Well, in a moment, we're going to talk about Star Trek and Twilight Zone and sci-fi with our dear friend Mark Sucree. Mark, as you know, is the author of The Twilight Zone Companion, has written over 100 dramatic television shows, including episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Babylon 5, Friday the 13th, the series. He's all over the place. In a moment, Mark Sucree on Coast to Coast AM. Well, sit back and enjoy yourself for a couple hours as we chat with Mark Sucree about The Twilight Zone and Star Trek and science fiction. If you're driving, don't sit back too far. Mark Sucree, of course, over 100 dramatic television credits to his name. As I mentioned, episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Babylon 5, Twilight Zone, Sliders. Mark has also served on the staff of four series, which include Sliders, Lazarus Man, Beyond Reality, and Friday the 13th. The series was my pleasure years ago when I first moved to the Los Angeles area to meet Mark, and what a delight he has been and a friend. Mark, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Really glad to be here, George.
You're like a regular staple here on the show, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Twilight Zone, Companion, movies, everything. Yeah. You're just keeping busy.
Well, it's great fun, and I just love the enthusiasm you bring to what you do. I really think that we're kindred spirits here.
Yeah. Star Trek has touched your heart.
Yes.
Not only this movie, but you've done some work in the past.
Yeah, and well, you know, also when I was a kid, when Star Trek debuted, it was just a tremendous opening for me in terms of just seeing what television could be like and what it could do. And I was given a Christmas present of a trip to the set when I was a kid, and I got to see them actually shoot the original Star Trek. And that was when I first started to think that maybe I could be a writer-producer working in TV. So that was the really set me on the path that I've been embarked upon all these years.
I've been getting emails for the last day and a half from people who are seeing the Star Trek movie, the new one, and they love it. Yep. One guy said, George, first 20 minutes, best I've ever seen on any film I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, I didn't like the whole thing, but I loved the first 20 minutes. And everybody else said they just loved it. What do you think?
I think it's a great job. I think that J.J. Abrams really took on something very difficult because there are so many fans who are just waiting for him to step on a landmine and just go the wrong direction. And, you know, it's not a perfect film, but it's a very good film. And I think that one thing that was very telling was I was talking with J.J. throughout this whole creative process, and I was on the set of the movie a couple times. And the first time I went on the set, J.J. was setting up a shot, and he came over to me and some of the other people I was with, and he said, well, what do you think of this shot? Is there a way to make this better? And I was just so amazed that he, as the director of the film, would be asking people and sincerely want their input. He was looking every moment for ways to make it better, make it stronger, make it truer. I think the spirit on the set was just very positive, very upbeat. I think he really deserves all the success he's had and will get from this as well.
Is that rare for a Hollywood director to take that kind of feedback from the people he's with?
It's rare, but I think it's vital. I think those of us who are always looking to do better work, you need that kind of input. You want to surround yourself with people who will give you suggestions that will make the work better.
What do you think about the movie?
I like it a lot, and I think that the cast is very, very good. Zachary Quinto, I think, plays Spock very well.
Looks like him.
Yeah, he does. It was uncanny. When you were on the set, you'd glance at him, and it was like Nimoy was there.
Younger version.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, and Chris Pine, you know, he's very different from Shatner, but he takes over Kirk and he makes it his own take on it. So and there's some very interesting surprises. I'm not going to spoil the plot. I want people to be able to see the movie who haven't seen it. But Winona Ryder plays Spock's mother, and that was a surprise. And she does a great job. She's really, really good. And so there's many things in the film that just you go, well, yeah, okay, that's really a good idea. Yeah, you bet.
We had Bill Shatner on the show a couple months ago, and I think he kind of wanted to be in this movie.
Yes, well, they're going to make another one, so there'll be another chance
they
up at that.
Bring him in.
Yes, you know? I think it would be a fun idea. It'd be really delightful.
Yeah, you know, and I know he's tough to work with, but he's good.
Yeah, and you know, there's all sorts of personalities in this game, but Shatner is unique. He's certainly made a career for himself, not just as Kirk, but he's great in The Twilight Zone, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. There are many things that he's done wonderfully well, and he's distinctive. I mean, it's very interesting. If you watch the first Twilight Zone pilot, it had a different actor, and then Shatner came on as Captain Kirk for the second pilot, and all of a sudden that chemistry kicked in, and between him and Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly, it was just a perfect balance of temperaments. So Shatner has that kind of incendiary, kind of edgy quality, but yeah. It really works in terms of performance.
You know, before the program here started, Mark and I were talking about just life in general and how, you know, just things just keep moving on. You know, my family in St. Louis and grandchildren and everything else, and Mark's situation here in L.A. Mark, Star Trek has touched so many lives of a generation that gets older.
Yes.
I mean, I remember it when I was a kid. I'm 58 years old now. Still a kid, but
yeah.
Not as young as I used to be. And, you know, and it kind of evolved. Picard,
yes.
All of it. We went through these changes.
Yes.
This one is pretty dramatic as well. Will it appeal to old-time fans? I'm sure it will to new ones.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I went to a screening today. I wanted to see how it played to an audience. I'd seen it a week ago at a Damon Lindelof screening of it at Paramount. And there was an interesting mix of the audience. There were the older fans and then clearly younger people who hadn't grown up with Star Trek. And it seemed to be working for both. We'll know over this weekend how it does. I think it's going to do very well. But it really does seem to appeal to both audiences. And I think that was very much what they were trying to do. They didn't want it to just appeal to the older fans. It wouldn't have succeeded if that was all they were trying to do. It has a younger audience, a younger cast. I think that all works quite well. I think the fact that the Star Trek actors are older now, a few of them have died. I think even the diehard first generation of Trekkers recognize that these actors cannot play these roles forever, and that it's time for new actors to step up and take on those roles. I think it works.
Yeah. Yet the franchise just lives on.
It does. It does. And you know, I was thinking about it today because there's the whole question of what's JJ's vision versus Roddenberry's, and mm-hmm. You know, but when I was thinking about it, well, you know, that wasn't the only. It wasn't only one vision. Roddenberry had his run with the series and with the early movies, but then there was a producer named Harve Bennett who came aboard for Wrath of Khan and some of the later films, and then Michael Piller came aboard on the Next Gen and Deep Space Nine and so forth. So you've had a number of different people. The real question with Star Trek is, will it be positive? Will it be life-affirming? Is it, you know, there's so many dark science fiction stories, Terminator and so forth, that show a dark, dreadful future. And Star Trek had hope in it. It said there's possibility, there's something positive to look forward in the future, a larger destiny for man. And I think that JJ is cueing into that. When I have lunch with him, when we talk, there's a sense of him being a very optimistic, very positive person. He has a great life energy about him. You know, he is like Rod Serling in that way. There's you know, he's aware of the darkness of humanity, but I think he also does offer hope. And it'll be interesting to see where he goes with his version of Star Trek in future films as well.
Leonard Nimoy was in this film. What was it like having two Spocks?
You know,
how'd they handle that?
I was very curious how that was going to play, and it works. It really does. And as you mentioned, George, there's a scene with the two of them, and it just seems like, okay, this is an older version of someone talking to a younger version. Mm-hmm. Now, they've done something very clever in this version, and it's been publicized widely, so it's not spoiling it, where it's basically a different timeline so that they can have these characters' destinies go to a different place than in the original series and in the subsequent movies. And that allows for a different possibility. So this Spock is actually a little more human, a little more emotional than Nimoy's. Nimoy's always seemed more
cool. Very cool.
He seemed more a Vulcan than human. He had emotions, yeah. But he was definitely a Vulcan. Zachary Quinto is playing it where his human side is perhaps the stronger of the two, and I think they play that well, and I think it's a good choice because there's new discoveries to be had, and I think the fans will definitely respond.
You know what I liked about Leonard's role, though, is, you know, you would see those tight shots of his face, knowing here's a scene where he should laugh, and you're waiting to see the smile or the smirk.
Yeah,
and it never came, and it was just priceless.
Well, you know, and also Leonard Nimoy has aged wonderfully. I mean, he obviously hasn't had cosmetic surgery. He's got this great craggy face. It's sort of like Bogart. When the older Bogart got, the craggier his face got, the more he looked like Bogart. He was great. And Nimoy's similar in that way, in that he's clearly an old man now, and yet you can just look at that face forever. It's just wonderful.
What was it like being on the set?
Well, you know, I just come off.
See, you're used to that.
Yeah, it was funny because I had just finished shooting the Star Trek episode that I co-wrote and directed starring George Takei, World Enough in Time. And so my first impression when I went onto the Star Trek set, JJ's set, was, well, this is old home week. I feel very familiar here. It's basically what I just been doing. But it was funny because the costumes, of course, are wonderful. They look very much like the original Star Trek costumes. The bridge set is different. Some people have said it's like a Pink Berry or an Apple Store. You get used to it. You know, it still works. And but the cast had a great energy. Everyone was really trying to make something wonderful. I talked to all of them when I was on the set. They were very friendly and warm, and there was a real ensemble feel. So it was quite a thrill to be there.
Did they have in the new version the superstar names from the past? I mean, was Bones in it and Scotty and
yes.
they were all in it too.
Well, the lovely thing is that Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman, who wrote the screenplay, they know Star Trek. And because when I was talking to JJ before he shot the movie, he was mentioning that he wasn't a big Trekkie, so he didn't know all the minutia. Whereas his screenwriters did, and it shows. And some characters I think work better than others. For instance, I love Simon Pegg. I'm a big fan of his films, but his Scotty for me doesn't work as well as James Doohan. The actor who plays McCoy isn't for me as strong as DeForest Kelly, and yet they're all working hard. They're all trying. And again, in the next Star Trek movie, they may have better bits of business or character turns, whatever. They may come into those roles. But of course, for the younger audience, they don't know DeForest Kelly and all of those actors. They're not going to have that same affection for those actors.
And you're working on the possibility of a Captain Sulu series?
Yeah, we've been, this is something, after we did the World Enough in Time, and it was so much fun directing George Takei, Michael Reeves, my co-writer, and I, along with Winston Engel, who's another writer that I know who worked on our episode, we came up with a Captain Sulu series. And we worked up a whole series Bible and a pilot episode in outline form. And we had meetings with certain Paramount executives, particularly on the website, the internet side, to discuss that. And it may ultimately come to fruition. I've talked to George Takei about it. I'd love to do it. And it would be great fun. I think eventually I'll put some of that material up on my website so people can see what we've been cooking up.
Now, the screening for a lot of people today or just a few?
Well, the screening with Damon Lindelof at Paramount was last week, and there were a lot of people from the industry. Bryan Singer, who directed the X-Men movies, was there, and he and I were talking. He's a big Twilight Zone fan, which is always fun. But today I just went to a regular theater and saw it with a regular audience because I love sitting there with my popcorn and
watching them too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think of myself as being part of this Hollywood elite. I think of myself as just being like anybody. I mean, I love making film and television, but I also love watching film and television. I'm as thrilled by a good movie as anybody anywhere.
Well, and that's what makes you successful, Mark. You're a real person.
Well, thanks.
What was the oohing and aahing of the crowd?
It was it was funny because the older fans got some of the references, and they'd laugh at some of the in jokes, whereas the younger audience, of course, wouldn't. But it's an extremely dynamic film. It's got a lot of action. It's got a lot of camera movement. JJ clearly was trying to create a visual vocabulary different from the previous Star Trek films. There's a certain kind of old-time standard way of shooting that the older films have, whereas JJ does a lot of camera movement, a lot of handheld kind of stuff, a lot of camera vibration. He also has lights shining into the camera lens, both in terms of the effects and the practicals.
See, he knows new technology, doesn't he?
Yes. Oh, yeah. He knows it backwards and forwards, yeah. And it really shows.
Yep, it does. And You know, they're lucky. They've got computers now.
Yes.
They can do all kinds of things.
Well, when I was shooting the Star Trek episode with George Takei, I realized that the frame is now totally malleable. You can really do anything with it. You can change anything in the picture. You can move it around. You can do amazing things now. You're only limited by your imagination and the budget.
And this was a pretty good budget movie, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was $130 million, and that's certainly enough to give you some elbow room.
That is. Well, stay with us, because when we come back, we'll talk with Mark Zuckerie about The Twilight Zone and also some other sci-fi related questions. Next hour, phone calls with Mark Zuckerie, and then later on tonight, yep, Friday into Saturday, open lines. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I am George Norrie, and here is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast. You ever see the Jersey Boys, Ian?
You know, it was just here, actually, a little while ago, and I haven't seen it. But everybody saw it, said they loved it.
It is great.
I saw the new Star Trek.
Well, I know. We're talking with Mark about it. Did you like it?
I just saw it. I just got back an hour ago. I just thought it was great.
Thumbs up, huh?
Yeah, oh, totally. It's so much fun. And they do, I don't know how the actors were able to get just the right voice technique. I mean, it's just, they almost sound a little bit like the originals, but not too much like that they're doing an impersonation. There's a little bit of Shatner and the guy that does Kirk. It's just great. It's a lot of fun.
I love it. What's on store this weekend?
Well, we got two big things. Looking forward to Saturday night. It's all about randomness. Now, I know, and I put this in the promo even, I know you always say that you don't believe in that everything, that there are no coincidences.
There are no coincidences.
But what this author argues tomorrow night, and I know you've spoken with him too, but I'm really looking forward to the Drunkard's Walk, is that he said the world is ruled by coincidence, by randomness.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much randomness that there's an order to it. And we'll get to that coming up to tomorrow night. And then on Sunday night, you know, with Angels and Demons coming, the new Dan Brown movie, you know, with Ron Howard and Tom Hanks, and with this new book that's coming out from Dan Brown all about the Freemasons in America, it's really timely to talk with Peter Lavenda about what his research says Masons really are responsible for in the formation of the United States, what we give them too much credit for, and what they perhaps have not been known for in the past, which we should be talking about, of the Masonic influence of the U.S., both in the early years and even today.
Super. Looking forward to it, Ian.
Thanks, George. Have a great night.
It's Ian Punnett this weekend on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We've got director and writer Mark Zuckerie here. Mark, tell us again, because it's always a great story, how you got interested in The Twilight Zone. Then you wrote The Twilight Zone Companion.
That's right.
The book. And then you went rummaging around Rod Serling's attic.
That's right. Exactly. Well, I grew up watching the original Star Trek, the original Outer Limits, and the original Twilight Zone. And when I got out of college, I realized I wanted to be a writer, producer, and television, but there were really no classes in that. So I decided that I would write a book about my favorite television show to see how you make a great TV show and learn from the best. So I interviewed a number of people. I actually ended up interviewing over 100 people who'd worked on the show, but principal among that was Carol Serling, Rod's widow, gave me access to all of Rod's materials. And so I literally spent several years literally crawling through Rod's attic, going through his scrapbooks, his files, taking home his 16-millimeter prints of the original episodes with the original commercials, the whole Megillah. And it was an incredible experience. It was wonderful. And then I wrote The Twilight Zone Companion, and it's still in print. It sold 500,000 copies, still going strong, and it was a great experience.
Aren't we into the 50th anniversary now?
Yes, George. And actually,
50.
That's right. And I'm actually here to make an announcement regarding The Twilight Zone that is a Coast to Coast exclusive. I thought I'd wheel this out for you guys.
All right.
And as I mentioned, I've interviewed over 100 people who worked on the show back when I did The Twilight Zone Companion. And for all the years since the book came out, those tapes have been pretty much in my home and nowhere else. And now we're making them available where people can actually go onto my website and download those interviews and hear them.
Super.
Yeah, and so we're starting with Buck Houghton, who produced The Twilight Zone, Doug Hayes, who directed it, George Clayton Johnson, who wrote for it, Ross Martin, who starred in it, George Clemens, who photographed it, and William Tuttle, who did the great makeup on things like Nightmare 20,000 Feet and Eye of the Beholder. So,
I love that.
Yeah, so for the first time, people will actually be able to listen to those interviews unedited, and I'm really glad finally to have the technology to be able to do that.
Zuckerie.com.
Yeah, exactly.
Z-I-C-R-E-E.com.
That's right. And these are the people that I learned from. There were there are no better people working in TV. And the fact that Twilight Zone is still the classic shows that they did their work right.
It's one of the best.
Yeah,
the message was unbelievable.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because many of my friends are running the top TV shows that are on now, and when we talk, we frequently watch The Twilight Zone even now. We go back to remind ourselves of what TV can do, of what you really should aspire to. I mean, J.J. Abrams, his big hero was Rod Serling. Certainly Joss Whedon is a fan of Serling. All these guys. And how could you not be? I mean, if you want to make great TV, you've got to look to the master.
Absolutely. I was reading some of the Serling scripts, and what a great writer.
Amazing writer. And the phenomenal thing is that he dictated those scripts. This is the writer's life, I'll tell you. He would get up in the morning, he would lounge by his Olympic-sized swimming pool in the backyard, and he would dictate into a little dictation machine.
He'd like float around or something?
No, he'd lounge by the side of the pool. He used to joke that he was the only writer who could write a script and get a tan at the same time.
Yeah.
And he dictated into the dictaphone, and his secretary would type it up, and then he'd make hand corrections. It would take him anywhere from 1 to 3 days to write an entire script.
He would create the actors and actresses in his head.
He'd act out those roles. He'd just do them and speak it into the mic. Now, early on in his career, before he became hugely successful, he typed like anybody. But around 1957, 58, he was dictating his scripts, and he did that through to the end of his life in 1975.
What was he like personally?
He was an amazing, amazing man. I never got to meet him personally. He spoke at UCLA one day that I was a student there, and I had a final that day, and I didn't go to hear Rod talk. And if I could go back in a time machine, I would certainly choose the other path, because I have no idea what that final was. But fortunately, when I was doing The Twilight Zone Companion, I came upon audio and videotapes of him teaching classes in writing, and that was really like being a fly on the wall. And the amazing thing when you watch Rod just candidly talking to people is he loves people. He knows all of their names, all of his students. He's talking to them just like anyone would talk to you. He has enormous interest in them, enormous humor and intelligence and compassion. Just a great guy all around. Not an egotist at all. Just really, I mean, it's sort of like if you wanted Rod to be your ideal Rod Serling of who you would want to meet and hang out with and have dinner with, he's exactly what that was.
Ironically, did he not die when he was 50 years old?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was funny because I was thinking
50th anniversary.
That's right.
And he died when he was 50.
Exactly. Amazing. And just it was so premature. He was a chain smoker, and you know, and he felt things very intensely.
He was born on Christmas Day.
That's right. And his father died of a heart attack as well, and so you know, of heart trouble. So, but the thing I was thinking about was how short Serling's career was when you think about it. The top part of his career was only 10 years. It was from about 1955 to 1964, 65. All of his great writing was done then. And then there was a second decade where he did Planet of the Apes, which wasn't bad either. But he had a Night Gallery and so forth. But he was much less happy the second decade. But his entire writing career was basically about 20 years total.
I liked Night Gallery, but after The Twilight Zone,
yeah.
No. It lost a little edge.
Well, Rod didn't have the authority and the say over things on Night Gallery the way he did in Twilight Zone. Twilight Zone was his show. The buck stopped with him. And certainly Buck Houghton and the other producers really were on his wavelength. And it really shows.
And all the episodes were black and white?
Yeah, they were. And there was some confusion about that because they had an episode called Miniature that years later, certain sequences were colorized, and people mistakenly thought that was shot in color. It wasn't. They were all black and white, but 6 episodes were shot on videotape as opposed to 35mm film, and so they have a slightly different look. And if you watch them on DVD or in syndication, you can see that they look more like live television than the other episodes, and that was the reason.
Mickey Carroll, a Munchkin, died yesterday in St. Louis, 89 years old.
Wow.
And I grabbed a little clip that we played on the show last night, but also, in looking at some of the video of The Wizard of Oz, it started off, as I now remember, in black and white.
Yes.
And then as she landed in Oz and opened up her door, she goes off into this colorful area.
Yeah. Amazing. And that Technicolor, of course, was just phenomenal looking back then.
What's new with Twilight Zone?
Well, there's talk of a new Twilight Zone movie. Leonardo DiCaprio was working on it, and there's a company called Legendary Films that does the Batman movies, a lot of other big features. So they've teamed with him, and they're talking to a lot of screenwriters. I actually met with them a few months ago.
So you think it's going to happen?
Oh, yeah, I do, absolutely. The challenge is how to do it well and how to do it right. And you know, it's so you listen to a lot of people, you bash a lot of ideas around until you find that one that really works. I mean, it's really amazing when something does work.
Well, the original movie, Twilight Zone movie, was based on 3 episodes.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So would this be through, episodes, or would it be just a fresh brand new story.
If it was up to me, I'd make it one story. I think it would be
and
much
a new
stronger.
One.
Yeah, yes. And it's funny because there are certain movies that actually are Twilight Zone movies. They're just not called that. If you look at E.T. or Field of Dreams, there are certain films that very much are like feature-length Twilight Zone episodes. And I think if I was running the show, that's what I would that I would do.
Serling was an inspiration to a lot of people, but also you.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And I still will go back to Walking Distance on some of these great episodes and just watch them. And it's just like, it reminds me. And I'm always pleased when some of my work gets compared with some of the Twilight Zone episodes. I'm very proud to be working in the same medium as Rod Serling.
Every episode, Mark, had some kind of social message behind it.
Yeah.
Every episode.
And I think that's why it's lasted, because I think if it was just about the twist ending or the shock moment, I don't think it would have stood the test of time, because you need to have a commentary on our life. There, it certainly had great compassion, and he also had a lot to say about politics and social issues and racial issues, and I think that's why it's held up. And I think, and even Star Trek, if you look at Star Trek, the original, Roddenberry was following in Serling's footsteps. Very, very few people know that Serling and Roddenberry were friends. In fact, Roddenberry delivered the eulogy at Rod Serling's funeral. So they very much were.
That.
Yeah, so Roddenberry was very much walking in Rod's footsteps.
Many of the things that Serling wrote in The Twilight Zone 50 years ago have come to pass, haven't they?
Yes, yes. And they're more timely than ever. If you look at some of those episodes, I mean, the fight against conformity, against all sorts of oppression, you know, all these things are always with us. Rod was writing about universal truths. And of course now, you know, with communications the way they are, with computers and so forth, automation, all of that, these are all issues that are more present in our life than back when Rod was writing in 1959.
And what I also liked is many of the stars that became top stars today started off entry level.
That's
in
right.
In those days. William Shatner was one. Robert Redford, he was another.
That's right. Lee Marvin, Robert Duvall. It goes on and on. Anne Francis was terrific in The Twilight Zone. Inger Stevens. I mean, it was just, they had the pick of the best actors working in film and TV at that time. Robert Cummings. I mean, many actors who wouldn't generally do television would do Twilight Zone because of those scripts. They would get that script and they would say, I've got to do this.
Yeah. They had fun with it, didn't they?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And the writers are still alive, many
yeah,
of them, right?
Yeah, yes. George Clayton Johnson, who wrote for Twilight Zone and Star Trek and co-created Logan's Run. Earl Hamner, who created The Waltons after he wrote 8 Twilight Zone episodes. Richard Matheson, who was a great Twilight Zone writer and then went on to do things like Somewhere in Time and I Am Legend.
Great
I mean,
movie.
These are amazing writers, and it's great to still have them with us.
And, of course, one of my favorites, two of them, of course. One was To Serve Man.
Yes.
And the other, of course, was Ray Bradbury's I Sing the Body Electric.
Yes, yes. And I was just seeing Ray on Wednesday. He and I see each other quite frequently. And he's still writing. He just had a new book come out. And we're actually talking about doing a project together. We're in talks about that now, where there's some of his material that I want to bring to television.
How cool would that be?
Oh, God, it would be great. And so Ray's very excited about this, and I am too. And we'll be announcing that down the road a little bit.
What's going on with Magic Time, one of your best-selling novels?
Well, thanks. Thanks for asking, George. We're going to bring that back to film and TV, so we're just shooting a trailer for it. I was working with some actors. We actually recorded it as a 90-minute radio play over the holidays to start generating what are called animatics, which are animated storyboards. And then we'll just see where we can get the money. And if it's a TV show, I'll run the show. If it's a movie, I'll write and direct it. And, you know, I love both forms. So it's just whoever steps up with the money, off we go.
I used to when I was producing a TV newscast in Detroit when I was 24, 25 years old, every time I'd go into the control room with the director, I was a producer and the audio guy and the sound people and the people who worked the board, the switchers and stuff. I'd always go in there and say, it's Magic Time.
Yeah, well, the basic idea in Magic Time is that it's modern day and all the machines in the world stop running and magic comes back. So it's like Lord of the Rings, but in the modern day. And it's a great, great fantasy to play with. And I love the characters. And it was fun to write the 3 novels. And now to come back to film. It started as a TV pilot. My wife and I wrote it. And then I did 3 novels. And now we're coming back to film and TV with it. And I just, I've been gathering my actors together. My friend Armin Shimerman, who played Quark on Deep Space 9 and the principal on Buffy, is one of our cast. And so we're just ramping up.
Mother's Day is Sunday, and I've got to ask you this, because I've been told by my sources that you're writing a book about your mother.
That's true. That's true. And, well, when people ask me what I write, I generally say, well, I've written a lot of science fiction and fantasy and horror, and I also write a lot about my weird family. So I've actually done 14...
You can't put mom in that category.
No. Certainly not with Mother's Day coming. My mom, I'm just finishing a memoir about my mother. It's called Love, Gloria. And I'm sending it off to the agents next week. I'm very pleased with it. It's very much in the Tuesdays with Maury or Marley and Me category. Many people don't know that I was a commentator on NPR's Morning Edition for 3 years telling stories about my family. And this is a story about how my mother learned to love. She was institutionalized as a child from the age of 5 to 15.
Oh my God.
During the Depression, she came down with tuberculosis, and she had no role models to love or be loved. And then during World War II, she was sort of a femme fatale, dating all these servicemen, getting engaged to two guys in one night, Army Air Corps flyers and
sure.
Navy guys, and incredibly handsome men. But she had no connection to anyone, really, was totally unconnected to anyone. Then she met a young woman who had a tragedy in her life. They were both about 19 or 20 years old. And this young woman had decided never to get married, never to have kids, just work in a terrible job, grow old, and die. And my mother decided to bring her out here to California from Chicago and remake her and get her happily married. And she did that.
That was her mission.
Yes,
right?
And she did that. And as a result of that relationship, learned how to love and be loved and became this amazingly loving person, not just to me, but to hundreds of people in her life, and saw this woman through to the end of her life, where the woman actually did have a loving husband and loving daughters. And it's the story of that. And it's been just such an honor to be able to write that story.
Did it, was it emotional for you?
Very, yes. Well, my mom's actually been gone for 20 years, and I interviewed her at length about her life before she died. She was this a remarkable person, and I really wanted to be able to share her story and her life and her personality with the world. And that's one of the great gifts of being a writer, is you can take these wonderful people you've known and these wonderful experiences you've had and share them with others. And I feel very honored to have that opportunity.
My mother's going to be 80 years old.
Wow.
The end of the month.
Congratulations.
So I'm going down for her birthday there.
That's great.
And my parents, as of August, would have been married 60 years.
Wow.
60 years.
That's amazing.
That doesn't happen anymore, does it?
No. Well, I have a friend who's about to turn 100, my friend Norman Corwin, who's a very famous writer from radio. He wrote the movie Lust for Life. And his dad made it to 105, so we're all crossing our fingers because, it's amazing when you can say to someone, tell me what it was like to know Eleanor Roosevelt. You don't get those conversations very often.
Of everything you've touched in your professional career, what project has stimulated you the most, has just been for you the passion of everything you've done?
Wow. Well,
and I know you're passionate about everything you do. Your TV shows, the movies, the books.
Yeah.
But is there one?
Well, this book about my mom, I think, is certainly the most personal. And I'm really happy to be. And it was funny because I was writing that book while I was directing the episode with George Takei, the Star Trek episode. So I was spending some of my time in the 23rd
century. Before you said take camera two, you were writing?
But it was funny because I'd be going between the 1930s and 40s and 50s and the 23rd century in what I was working on. But also the episode with George Takei that I got to co-write and direct and executive produce, that takes so many of your different skills and so much of your focus. And to be able to grow up watching Star Trek and then to be able to work with George Takei and bring that to fruition and be nominated for the Hugo Award, which is the top award in science fiction.
Yeah,
it was, that meant a lot to me. But as you said, George, it's sort of like whatever I'm working on, I sort of put my whole heart into. And I think that's the secret of doing a good job. It's certainly what Serling was doing, and many of my friends who create the films and TV shows that we all love, that's what they're doing. They always put it on the line. They put their heart right out there.
Is there still a market for new writers to come here and
work? Sure. Oh, yeah, you bet. I mentor hundreds of writers and directors and producers and actors. And in fact, my assistant, I just mentored him, and he just got hired at Warner's, and they want to make his feature, the screenplay that he just wrote. And I say to them, Write what you love. Write what you care about. It doesn't have to be what you've lived, but it has to be where your heart lies. And, it's not about erasing yourself or being a chameleon or trying to imitate others. It's about really finding what you're passionate about and putting that out into the world. And that's what works. But I think Hollywood is always open to someone with something fresh and a story to tell.
Were there times that you would write a script and then throw it away?
Yeah.
You got mad at it. You didn't
like it. Well, sometimes, yes. Or sometimes you write something that's not quite there yet. I'm working on a new pilot, and I'm working also on a new feature script. And it's going to take a few more drafts to get them where I want them to be. And my wife reads my work and gives me notes. And I have other friends. My friend Mark Fergus, who co-wrote Iron Man, he's a sounding board on the new feature. And so I surround myself with these friends who will give me notes and be a, you know, tell me what to do.
All right, we're going to take phone calls with you next hour.
Great.
All right. Phone calls about Star Trek, Twilight Zone, writing films. We'll do it next hour with Mark Zakuria on Coast to Coast AM.